This is Arrivals. Stories of migration, transformation, and change. The program that explores what we do when what we've done is a thing of the past. And today, we bring you the story of an agent.
My name is Katie Nienaber. I've lived in San Francisco for almost 9 years. My parents met and got married here, but by the time I came along, we were living elsewhere. I have one younger sister. She's 2 years younger than me. We moved around about every 5 years. I've lived in the Washington, D.C. area. I've lived in Anchorage, Alaska. Yeah, we just moved around every few years. And the reason for that was because my father was an FBI agent. He wasn't the kind of guy who walked around in suits and sunglasses all the time. It certainly wasn't that. He wore Levi's and flannel shirts to work because he was busy building robots that could, on wheels, that could go into a building and take apart a bomb so that it wouldn't explode. Or a robot that had a camera on it that could go into a building and find out where the hostages were in the room so that people could go in and rescue them. A funny thing is about watching fictional portrayals of your job in the media, we watch movies where things would explode, you know, like Die Hard or whatever. And it got to be a joke in our family because he would critique the explosion. He would say, "Oh, that's not real," or like, "That is not how it would happen." Be it the way things, the trajectory of the glass or the color of the smoke. He's like, "That's fake." The older the movies were, the more realistic the explosions were, because back then there was no CGI. They had to really blow it up. Or, you know, I remember once we were watching The Fugitive, which is such a great movie. And at the end, towards the end of The Fugitive, they're in the basement, they're in the laundry room of a hotel, and it's just all cinder block cement walls, and they're on walkie-talkies. And he just shook his head like, you can't get reception in a basement like that. Like, your radios won't work. Growing up, it was no big secret at all that my dad had been in the Army. There were small little artifacts of that around our house just here and there. His old camouflage jacket that said Nienaber on the pocket. The government took note of how good he was during his time there and how intelligent he was, and they had him come to Quantico to teach classes to agents about bomb disposal, which I think at the time was very unusual to have someone who was not an agent, who was still in their early 20s, to show up and teach classes to these people who either were agents or were on their way to becoming so. And so he did that a couple times, and then he wanted to join the Bureau himself. So you have to take all these tests, physical tests, written tests. At the time, it was really hard. I'm sure it's even more difficult now. And when he got in, he did different things, but I think his favorite thing was still the bomb disposal stuff. It was his bread and butter. So, you know, I went to college. I was about an hour south from where we live, still in Oregon. And, you know, just going through your first months of college, figuring things out. And then it was time for spring break. And my parents drove down to pick me up from the dorms. And we were getting ready. You know, my mom was there and my sister was there. And we were getting ready to go to get into the car. And my dad's like, "Hey, hold on a second." And he walks with me down this sidewalk, and it's like, it was a sidewalk that went nowhere, and I was thinking, why are we walking down this random sidewalk? Like, there's nothing at the end of this road. And he held my hand, which almost never happened, And I just got this feeling. I was like, this is a moment where someone tells you something important. And as it turned out, I was right. And he broke it down for me. I'm sick. As it turned out, I'm very sick and I'm going to have an operation. I have cancer. And I kind of didn't, you know, how does one digest that? He went to the doctors like for regular checkup. This man was 48 years old and they were feeling around in his stomach because he was saying like, oh, I'm doing all these ab exercises. I want to get my flat belly back again and all that. And he says, you know, this one side feels pretty good. Like it feels pretty muscular, but then the other side is still like all lumpy. And the doctors felt his stomach and they were like, oh no. And the thing that he felt in his stomach that he thought was like a nice hard ab muscle was actually a tumor. So he went into surgery and they took it out and I heard at some point that it was the size of a grapefruit, which is pretty big. And they said that for something to grow that fast, it would have been very aggressive. In this particular instance, you remove the tumor and then you kind of just have to wait and see if it had metastasized, which means if the cancer had spread to other parts of your body, you kind of just have to see if that is what had happened. It was time to go home for summer break. So this time my mom and my sister picked me up from school. My dad was behind because he was recuperating. He wasn't working anymore. They picked me up from the dorms again and parked along that same curbside. And my mom, we didn't even make it to the car. My mom sat down on the grass of the dormitory and she said, well, turns out it came back. The cancer came back. It's in his bones and lungs, I think she said. And it was this sunny, beautiful day, and it was an Oregon spring. And everyone was walking around us. Other people were moving out of the dorms carrying moving boxes, and I'm sitting here just really trying to understand what that meant. I had never known anyone in that point in my life who had actually died from it. So in my mind, this was a bad thing that happened, but then you got over it. And later that night when my parents had gone to bed, my sister sensed something. I think she sensed that I kind of had not received the message. And we sat at the kitchen table in our kitchen. It was dark. It was just the light above the kitchen table. And she said, I don't know if Mom said this in a way that you understand. She said, but Dad's not going to get better. I remember specifically she said, he's never going to walk us down the aisle. He's not even going to see me graduate from high school. I got it. I got the message. The rest of that summer was incredibly hard. Just a lot of trips back and forth to the hospital. Just watching this person who was very strong, not just physically strong as a person, but sort of as a pillar of strength in your life. An adult who you admire and respect, and just watching them get weaker and physically smaller, you know, losing body fat, losing hair, losing muscle. as the summer was drawing to a close, his birthday is in September. It's one of those questions that just comes out of your mouth. What do you want for your birthday? And he said nothing. Not in a depressed way, but in a way that was very realistic and very much looking this in the eye, which he had the maturity and foresight to do, which I, by this time I was 19, I just really couldn't grasp it.
Homer, I've gotten you the most important gift a man your age can get.
Having your boobs embiggened? You don't have to, they're fine.
Just I remember we were watching The Simpsons, which we did all the time. And it was some episode where, honestly, it was like Homer either had cancer or was just really sick and in the hospital. And at one point, Lisa says, "You're not gonna die, are you?" And Homer in his... you know, ignorance says, "Of course not. That only happens to bad people." And I'm sitting there with my dad, who has no hair, who is getting ready to be in hospice at this point. And, you know, we had watched The Simpsons almost every day of our lives for the last, you know, 10 years. And he says, "Could we change the channel?" And I remember feeling like I had let him down somehow, like I hadn't seen the arc of this story on The Simpsons. I hadn't picked up on it quick enough to maybe, oh, hey, let's find something else to watch. You know, it hits you. It reminds you, like, oh, yeah, like we're traveling down this road and there's no turning back. And after that, I was a little bit removed of what was going on. Just starting my sophomore year in college. And then one day, my mom called me. It was in the morning. And she said, this was a landline phone. I had no idea who was calling me. But I had grown to dread the sound of the phone ringing because I was like, no one's going to call me to tell me anything good. So the phone rang. I answered it. And there was this pause at the other end of the line, just this silence, and it's my mom's voice cracking, and she says, "Katie, it's Dad." And I thought, oh dear, like, this is it. Like, something's, like, she wouldn't be calling me unless something really bad was happening. And we drove up back to my parents' house, a drive that I had made many times in my life, getting through the front door, and my whole family, save for my dad, is just standing at the bottom of the staircase. They're just standing there, kind of looking at me, but not looking at me. So I run up the stairs into my parents' bedroom and to their bed, where he had been just laying for the past month. And I turn the corner, I get into the room, and he's laying in bed, and his eyes are open and his mouth is open. And it was just, I knew immediately. I was like, oh, he's gone. Like, that happened really fast. And I definitely remember just collapsing to the ground. And I cried very intensely for a while. Because you anticipate this time coming, you anticipate it, but until it's actually in the room with you, you never know what it's really gonna be like. For years and years afterwards, I'd be driving down a highway, and I'd see, you know, a middle-aged white guy on a bicycle. I would always look in the rearview mirror. And that was partially just like an instinctual thing. But also part of it was hope. You know, maybe that's him. You know, maybe it was all just a bad dream. it really kind of turned my world upside down, because again, it was coming back to this idea of, why did this happen? What was the action or reason that brought this about? People don't get cancer for no reason. Or do they? It was always really impressed upon us, like, this is very unusual. This is very rare and strange and mysterious. Especially for someone that young, still in their 40s, and someone who lived a healthy life. It just didn't make sense. So, and life went on. I missed him terribly. I would look for him in the rearview mirror of my car. And eventually, in 2004, I was accepted to graduate school in Chicago, and I moved out there, and I met a girl in my program named Rebecca. And Rebecca was sort of a very petite, thin person my age, and she walked with a very slight limp. And one day she wrote an essay about her limp, but it was really much bigger than that, of course. She had been born with a broken hip, and she had had a lot of hip surgeries as a child. She missed years of school from being in body casts and dealing with that. She was one of, I believe, four girls, her mom and her dad living a Midwest existence. And as I read her essay, Rebecca started talking more about her family. And she mentioned that her dad had been a Vietnam veteran and had done his thing, come home, and had a family, as did thousands and thousands of others. And as it happened, with each of his children, they were all born with some sort of birth defect. And as they got older, it was revealed to them, oh, when your dad was in Vietnam, he had been exposed to Agent Orange. Agent Orange is a code name for one of the many chemical defoliants manufactured by the United States government to kill and or burn the plant life and vegetation specific to that region. First of all, in the country of Vietnam, the after effects there, I think especially in the countryside, are huge. There are still children born to this day where they look completely normal, but their legs are facing backwards. These biological abnormalities that are completely traced back to that kind of chemical warfare. About a year later, my sister got married and was pregnant. And in this process, she had an ultrasound, and it was discovered that she has what is called a bicorneate uterus. And that is a condition where a woman's uterus basically wants to split itself in two. So imagine the shape of a heart. Like, normally a uterus would be sort of this, I don't know, blobby shaped thing, but with this it's as if it's trying to divide itself in two. So it's an exceptionally rare birth defect. It's in less than 1% of all women. And it's something that you would never ever know about yourself unless you have an ultrasound. It's the only way that anyone would know. I was in my last semester of grad school, and I flew back to Portland to visit some friends. And it was winter, and the rain was pouring down, and I had some time to kill, so I ended up going to the movies alone, which I actually do quite often. It's kind of nice. And I'm there at night in the dark, and the movie that I chose to see was this movie called Bobby.
I've heard a rumor that someone's trying to unload tickets for tonight's Dodgers game.
And I don't think it's a very memorable film, 10 years later. It was directed by Emilio Estevez. It's this all-star cast. There's 20 incredibly famous people in this movie. And it takes place during a single day, the day that Robert Kennedy was assassinated at the Ambassador Hotel. And the whole movie takes place inside the hotel, and it's about the staff that works there, primarily fictionalized versions of the staff that works there, and what they're going through, the political climate. And it's just this slice of all different kinds of people who live in LA and the stuff that they're dealing with. And of course, a shadow hanging over a lot of this is the Vietnam War. So there really, you never really see Kennedy's face in the movie. Like, there's an actor who portrays him, but he's a very minor character at the very end of the movie. Because when he was killed, it was late at night. So it starts at the beginning of the day, and it goes on and on. And I'm just sort of getting swept up in the movie and all of the dramatics that are going on. And in the last, like, 2 or 3 minutes of the movie, they'd show film reels, real film reels, not shot to make it look like a reenactment, but actual news reels from the Vietnam War era of people in the jungle with Robert Kennedy's voice layered over the top, talking about how he wants to end the war and how it's and how terrible it is and all of that. And I don't know how else to describe it, but it just dawns on me. Oh, this is it. This is why. It immediately went to my dad. It was Agent Orange. That has to be it. And I got so excited that I did the thing I never do, which is get up and leave the movie early, even though I knew it was over. Because my thought was, I have to tell someone. I have to call my mom. I left the theater, I go out onto the sidewalk, it's night, and the rain is just coming down. And so I call up my mom, and I'm just blubbering all of this. I just saw this movie. Oh, there's this girl I go to school with named Rebecca. Oh, my sister, her birth defect. I sing, Mom, 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 I think I know why. I think I know why he got sick. I think it's because of Agent Orange. And first thing out of my mom's mouth, she goes, oh yeah, I knew that's what it was. We just kind of assumed that that's probably what it was. But there's really no way to prove it. She told me that he once said to her, oh yeah, I definitely saw all of that. And when we were close to it, they gave us these plastic gloves that we were supposed to wear. As if plastic gloves would have done anything, really. Why she had never really shared that thought with me, I wasn't really sure, but it really didn't matter. I wasn't upset with her. Because really, like, maybe in her mind she thought, well, it doesn't change the fact that he passed away. It doesn't change anything, really. But for me, I was more at peace. Because now there was a reason. And it wasn't just lightning striking out of the clear blue sky and striking down this man in the prime of his life. It's like, no, there's a backstory. There's a reason. I don't dwell on it. It's not something that guides my day-to-day life. But every once in a while, it'll just sort of like come up in an unexpected way. For example, last Memorial Day, I was at home and heard something on the radio or something like, oh, today's Memorial Day. And I thought to myself, ah, Memorial Day, like, that's different from Veterans Day, because Memorial Day is when you honor people who actually died in a war. And I stood there and I thought about both my grandfathers, who had both been in World War II, and like, well, they served, but then they came home and, you know, went on with life. And I thought to myself, I've never known anyone who's died because of a war. And I sat with that for half a second, and then I thought, well, actually, how true is that?
Special thanks to Katie Nienaber for sharing her story. Agent was produced by me, Jonathan Hirsch, with help from our associate producer, Nora Lind. Episode art comes to us from Steph Tan. If you like what you've heard, check out our website. You can join our newsletter, follow us on Twitter and Facebook, and listen to the entire Arrivals catalog at ARRVLS.com. You can also find us on iTunes, Spotify, Acast, Stitcher, or wherever you go to download podcasts. Arrivals is a proud and founding member of The Herd, an audio collective featuring 8 independent producers from across North America who have banded together to share resources and promote one another's work. Find out more at theherdradio.com. That's H-E-A-R-D radio.com. And some of the tracks you've heard in this episode, including the one you're listening to right now, comes to us from producer and sound designer Shawnee Aviram. I've collaborated with Shawnee on a new small batch music library called Liminal, where you can go to license crafted music compositions like the ones you hear on this show. Check us out at liminalaudio.com. That's L-I-M-I-N-A-L audio.com. I'm Jonathan Hirsch. Thank you for listening. And until we meet again, may you wind up where you need to be.